big question, really.
Who knows?
What we do know, and I guess the first part of this question is we need to acknowledge that it's going to take us to places we really have no idea. That we can guarantee. 7 years ago, Facebook, YouTube did not exist. They are now the two most visited sites on the internet that have changed society quite drastically. So something in the next 7 years is going to appear and do the same, and we have no idea what it is. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that exciting? By way of a kind of excuse, I just said to John and Anne, yesterday morning I got up sitting at my desk having morning coffee, kind of looking around the internet, looked at my diary and it said this day was like tomorrow. I'd put this into the middle of next week for some reason. I don't know why. I guess I wanted it to be next week. So if it's not quite as sleek and kind of integrated as it might be, it's because, well, it was a fairly quick job, but as John just said, because I work on the internet, I'm good at that, you know, like, don't need any time, just whip things up. You have to work really fast. So where's the internet taking us? Let's look at a few things about technology first. Some theories that kind of put it in a framework. Now, if we look at that question, where is the internet taking us literally, then we're looking at that theory number one of technological determinism, which basically says technology is in control and it's taking us wherever it wants to take us. The other theory, the second one there, is the social construction of technology, which is an interesting one. It's like saying that we as a species only create the things that we're ready for, and that we collectively somehow have reached this subconscious agreement that we're ready for the internet, or we're ready for whatever technology that we're talking about. So it's not about technology driving us. We create it when we're ready and want it. And the third theory there talks about social shaping, where technologies have logics, as Nancy Baim calls them, or Nicholas Carr called them ethics. And they're the messages that a tool or medium transmits into the minds and culture of its users. So it's saying that, okay, we create it, but then it changes us. And that's always a fascinating process to watch, and perhaps never before in the history of humanity have we got such a golden opportunity to observe how we're changing, not only as a result of technology, but in this particular case, how are we changing because of technology? Let's just go back, a bit of revision. 1997, I think, was the year. TAFE gave everybody the internet. Came in, logged in on February 1997, and there was this thing called the internet. Netscape 3. It was on my desktop. And as wonderful and exciting as it was really just a book in those days. The internet was a place where there was a lot of resources, a lot of information that we basically read. And only people who had the skills in HTML or creating a website got to have stuff on the internet. So it was a relatively selective club. Fast forward to the next version, and we do talk about Web 2 or Internet 2.0, also referred to as the read-write web, and this phrase came from Tim Berners-Lee, the guy who actually invented the internet. And interestingly, he said that Web 2 was what he always imagined the internet would become. The passive version in Web 1 was not what he was thinking when he built it. He was thinking about Web 2. Stephen Downes, maybe the world's most influential commentator in educational technology, drew up a little draft of the companion notion of e-learning 2 and compared 1 and 2 there. So e-learning 1, education is about static packaged content, little true interactivity and learner input, very little contact with the teacher in the electronic space, represented by learning management systems. E-learning 2.0, more student-centred, students generate and share content. It's based around a personal learning environment, and students interact not only with their teachers, but with their peers, and indeed anybody in the world who can help them. Now, sadly, what we're still doing in TAFE SO most of the time is e-learning 1, and it's not just TAFE, it's a global problem. Teachers find it really difficult to move to this 2.0 model of delivery. It's what is happening in the real world, it's how people are functioning in their own lives, but it's difficult to translate it into the educational context. So We all know that Web 2 was dominated by social media. There was an explosion of tools that allowed us to generate content, to write to the web, not just read it, to write to it and contribute to it. So it became our web. And I'm always like to kind of, Stephen Downes says this, when people complain about Wikipedia, oh, it's wrong or it's stupid, he just says, well, change it. Right? It's yours. Go in there and change it if you think it's wrong. It's an example of how the internet has changed. Of course, Facebook led the charge. It's now estimated that Facebook is responsible for 80% of all internet traffic. So it nearly is the internet. And I personally resent that, but that's a whole other story. Because people who used the internet before Facebook existed, we didn't need Facebook. We did all these things in other places. There were other places, and now Facebook basically tries to, and has done very successfully, offer all these tools and functions that we all, well, we wanted them, we needed them, and it's all in one place. So Facebook's done an amazing job. Interesting, isn't it? Well, it is, I think, that the number of users, the number of new users in Facebook finally plateaued, that they say, in 2012. Prior to that, it was an exponential increasing number of people signing up each year. So it's stabilised. So maybe Facebook has reached its peak. Maybe. And it's interesting to contemplate that in China and India, there are other social networking sites that have huge numbers of users, like millions, and that's probably one of the reasons that Facebook has plateaued. The truth is still, though, and even more so, that the knowledge is in the network. So now that we've got this connected world, the internet has joined us all up, we're all able to read and write to the internet and communicate with whoever we need to. The argument runs that we no longer need to actually remember as much as we used to. We don't need to keep it in our own mind anymore. One, because it's actually impossible, because no matter what field of expertise you're in, the amount of data available every day just grows exponentially. People are Twittering now, they're blogging now, they're writing stuff on Facebook now about anything and everything. So the amount of information, stroke knowledge, about every topic known to humanity increases by the second. So you can't keep abreast of it all. It's impossible. So the only way you can do it is to be part of a network and this kind of arrangement where you're all joined up and you know who to ask. If you have a question that you don't know the answer to, you need information, you go out to your network, and those of you who do that will know that your network, if it's an effective one, you'll get the answer within minutes, maybe an hour or two. So it's like just-in-time learning. The information is in the network. You don't need to hold it in here anymore. Now, the Internet version 3, I haven't heard people talk about Internet V3 for at least a year. And prior to that, it was a fairly common way of describing the new Internet, whatever it would be. But it's dwindled. The use of that term has trailed off. So it's like, it doesn't seem to be a convenient cover-all tag, and maybe the difference between Internet 1 and Internet 2 is sufficiently different. You could actually say, well, here was the change. Prior to this technology, the Internet was like this, and then there was social media or associated technologies, and that was Web 2. Maybe the difference between 2 and 3 is more evolutionary. I'm just guessing here. I just think it's interesting that you don't hear Internet 3 as much as you used to. You used to hear people talk about the semantic web all the time, and I always had great difficulty understanding what that was, and I reread it again last night and thought, yes, it's difficult to understand. But it too seems to have trailed off as a popular term. So there is no general phrase or generic phrase that seems to be talking about the new internet at the moment. So it's like we're waiting for one. So I've decided to use, in the meantime, the Internet of Things, because that is a big trend that's releasing the internet from screens. There used to be an ad on TV that an LG fridge that would have a little computer on the front and would tell you when you're out of milk or you need potatoes or whatever was in your fridge. It was actually monitoring what was in your fridge and it was connected to the internet. It would send you a message to your phone. When you're out, you need milk. So that's an example, and we'll look at more in a minute, of the Internet of Things. But the internet has been released from screens. So what's on the horizon? And this is reference to the Horizon Report that many of you will know about. The Horizon Report is a report that's been released every year for the last 10 years, looking at educational technology, and tries to predict what technologies are going to be mainstream in education within particular time frames, near term, mid-term, and longer term. And this was what this year's Australian Horizon Report said was going to be on the agenda, so you can see that in the very near term, learning analytics, massive open online courses or MOOCs, mobile learning and social media. And I'd say that's been pretty much right. You can always argue about the accuracy of these predictions, and they're not meant to be a golden rule. They're just guides. They're a best guess, really. We might come back to some of the earlier ones later, but I want to jump forward to a couple of the ones in the 4 to 5 year time frame, which I think are more likely to have a profound impact, not only on education, but on all of us in all our lives. And it is the Internet of Things and wearable technology. So the Internet of Things is, maybe it helps to think about this as a network now, where objects like fridges are connected to cars, which are connected to phones, which are connected to boats, which are connected to animals. So the Internet now is starting to show up everywhere. And the most common thing that we see is these examples here of tracking and monitoring information in wildlife, consumables, health and inventory management, just as a few examples. I saw a documentary just last week on the behaviour of Port Jackson sharks in Sydney Harbour. And they were putting little chips in these sharks, and the reason for doing this is to try and establish where the sharks go and who they hang out with, actually, whether they have a social structure, and indeed whether they have friends that they prefer to be with, in contrast to other sharks. And early data suggests they do. Port Jackson sharks have friends, they have groups that they hang out with, and they don't hang out with that group as much. And they're discovering this because of these chips that are embedded in these sharks, which are being monitored on the internet. So it's sending data the whole time back to the internet, which people can track. Consumables refers to things you buy, and I know the technology exists, but it hasn't happened in Australia yet, and it is happening in some places because of the barcode. Well, that the barcode can be linked to an internet monitoring tracking service. When you buy that bottle of milk and you go home, it will actually track it with you. It knows where you are, or it knows where that bottle of milk is. It knows that it was bought at Port Adelaide and it was taken to Salisbury or wherever, and so they can actually start to get a very clear pattern of where the stuff is bought in that shop. So it's tracking via internet monitoring where things go. They're not tracking you, they're tracking the item. And that's good data for a shop to know whether or not they need to pitch to Salisbury residents, because lots of their stuff actually ends up in Salisbury. Health's a really interesting one. I might come back to that in a minute, but there's lots of really amazing things happening in health. Inventory management is a bit like that fridge one. So you've got a number of items that get used, and it can be monitored automatically by an internet sensor, which will send messages. This example here about saving energy using the Internet of Things comes from Sweden, and this is where it starts to get really not only useful, but incredibly exciting, because they have it's about a matchbox, it's a sensor that just sits in your house, and it governs, it monitors temperature and light and drafts and humidity, moisture, all these things that affect the temperature and the climate, the comfort factor in your apartment or your house, and it sends that data to a computer, or in fact it can be also programmed to turn on the air conditioning or turn off the air conditioning or turn off the lights or dim the lights, and it has a whole range of functions. And early results of this technology is that it's about a 15% saving on your energy bill just for you doing nothing. Just have the thing doing its thing in the background, and it will monitor the amount of energy you need to use, and this is a good thing, obviously, for the planet. This little device over here, already you can pre-order for $279 at ubi.com. And it's a little device, which again, is about the size of a matchbox, plugs into the wall and talks to the internet, and you can talk to it. And it's been particularly touted as a great thing for people with disabilities, because you can be sitting in your chair, or you can just be lazy, and you're reading a book, and you want to know about, what's the biggest city in Sweden? And you just talk to this thing, and it goes off to Google, and it will talk back the answer to you, or it will send a message to your phone, which is sitting there, so you don't have to move. So your experience of the internet starts to be one that's 24/7, it starts to be audio-based, and it's very much just like you talking to, I don't know, a friend. And that's Ubi. You can't buy them yet, but when they do that pre-order thing on the internet, they're internet, so you might like to get an Ubi. So this is the Internet of Things, and just a few examples of how it's happening. The other big one, which is going to turn the world on its head, is this wearable computing stuff. I know some of you will have been already had some experience with point-of-view technology, POV, where you put on the glasses, and for people particularly in the trades, where you have to demonstrate the use of a skill. This is great evidence for an assessor or an auditor, because you're actually recording what you're doing with your hands while you're narrating. You could actually say that I'm picking up this jug and I'm lifting the cup and I'm pouring the water into the jug. Obviously, it's a more complex technical task, but the whole thing is narrated. It's filmed and narrated. So you've got a beautiful little learning object there which proves that you have that skill. So that's around and that's being used in TAFE. The next step, of course, Google never settles. It just goes to the next thing, and there's Google Glass. Anyone seen one yet? Got one? Yeah, I don't know whether you can get them here yet. I've seen a couple of people in Europe walking around with them. There are hundreds of them in the United States. They're basically a 24/7 recording device. They're recording everything they see and hear. So as they walk around their life, it's a 24/7 recording, which is going onto the net. And it does a whole lot of other things besides, but in terms of the thing I think that's most threatening, it's that. This little yellow box here is the still image equivalent. They are available. You can buy those for about $250 on the internet right now. They sit just there and they take a photograph every 30 seconds. So you can just walk around all day long and take photographs of everything, and at the end of the day or at the end of a given period, go back and take the ones that are good and junk the rest. And they turn up some surprisingly good photographs. I don't know the answer to the question, the point, but in the end, whether or not I see a point is kind of irrelevant, because I know there are lots of other people who will just do it, and they will find a point. And
it's like turning the internet into a garbage dump, isn't it? Like just putting everything that's
It's
not a garbage
dump now.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's not an overblown garbage dump now. Have you been on YouTube?
But, you know, really good questions.
There'd be some issues of privacy in that too.
No, you're not kidding.
People who wear those are already being referred to as glass holes. They're getting beaten up for recording people.
Oh, wow.
We'll come back to it in a minute, to the privacy thing. We'll just go to the good side of it's wearable technology for a minute. This is from Melbourne. They're called the Bionic Laboratory. They've actually developed an eye, and that's what this guy is holding. They've developed a bionic ear. We're not far away from basically regenerating damaged parts in the human body. My dentist actually told me the other day when he was doing something in my mouth, he said, 5 years' time, we'll just grow a tooth in here. I won't be doing this. I'll just put a little stem cell in there. It'll just grow back. About 5 years. But devices can be implanted in the brain or are being implanted in the brain to treat seizures, pain, psychiatric conditions, Parkinson's disease. Electrodes half a millimetre thick have been designed to insert into the brain, detect abnormal activity and deliver instant treatment. So this is where it gets really quite amazing. So they will detect Alzheimer's, for example. They'll detect Parkinson's disease, Parkinson's disease in advance. And a whole range of other conditions, they know now what brain activity signals this change, and they'll get it before it actually becomes a real thing in the body. So this is a brilliant use of wearable technology, where you can actually predict and prevent serious illness. So we should all be living to 150. Google Glass. All right, so some people are getting beaten up. This graphic here is not particularly legible, I imagine, but this study here on the left says 70% of the of those polled said they would buy it. 70% of people across of all ages said they will buy it. 57% said it will change the way that we behave. Well, no, that was... and that it will become socially acceptable. If given the option of a watch, Dick Tracy style, or the Google Glass, 74% went for the Google Glass as against 25 on the watch. But that was one poll. The second one on the right, done in Britain, study of over 4,000 people. One in five Britons were uncomfortable with the privacy implications surrounding the Google Glass and believed it should be banned outright. It's not going to happen. They will not ban it outright. I can see that it will be banned in certain contexts like customs, police stations, banks, but we're going to have to deal with the fact that all people are walking the streets filming everything in front of them. Half these respondents expressed a general mistrust about the invasive nature of wearable technologies such as Google Glass. Look, whatever we think, the world is queuing up. 70 cents, they're going to buy them. They're going to be out there, and we're going to have to deal with it on a daily basis. Now, going back to what I said earlier about technologies have ethics or logics that transmit to the minds and culture of its users, that is, it changes who we are. Has anyone actually put on peer point of view technology? Does it? Did you have that? It changes you. It just changes what you're doing and how you're thinking and where you... just immediately you become this other person with this other vision. And good or bad, it does. That it, and it's instant the moment you put these things on.
How? Well, you'd feel, as a woman, I'd feel safe wearing those glasses. Because there'd be evidence if you're attacked. And the perpetrator would see that, and so they wouldn't attack you.
Police.
Yeah, still, the message has already been transmitted somewhere.
Yeah.
That this person is approaching you, so I'd feel quite safe wearing that. So
police
that would change
Britain?
My behaviour, because I'd go to places which I normally wouldn't go.
Please. Well, just how you become a camera. Like I walked on the beach with these things, and I didn't just walk on the beach. I started to become a camera. I started to look at things very specifically and move down a little bit closer because I wanted a good video. Sad, really. This is what McLuhan said many decades ago, same idea, that we create the tools and thereafter they shape us, they change us. So let's just be realistic. Controversial, maybe, microchips in humans, apart from the medical examples, it's not if, it's when. I have a colleague who works very closely in this field. He's doing a PhD in this wearable computing, and he regularly attends events where there are police, army, security. And he said for them, they can't bring it on fast enough because it's just going to make their lives so much easier. There are already a couple of nightclubs in the world. I think there's one in New York, there's one in Berlin, where you don't get in unless you've got a chip. That's your entry credit. If you don't have it, you don't get in. And it just pops up a little picture with some data about you. So people on the door, police, security, there's no way you can fool these things into thinking you're someone else. The whole idea of identity checking is dealt with. So I find that scary, but I take it that it's just a matter of time. So that the privacy thing. A really good book to explore this idea is written by a guy called Jeff Jarvis, and the book's called Public Parts. And given that we are faced with this world that's going to be presenting us with these challenges on a daily basis, we need to start thinking about these things. And one of the questions that he asks is, privacy dead? And he basically comes to the conclusion it is. Apart from in your own home, the moment you walk out the door, you're monitored, tracked, filmed 1,000 times a day. And the last, most recent one I noticed was the new car park at the airport. When you drive in there, and there's all these lights around that tell you green light means it's an empty space. So you drive into the green light, space, and it goes red.
Yes.
And you know that it's a camera.
Yes.
I'm sure that camera is taking a photograph of your registration plate.
That technology is already being used at, I live near a shopping centre that actually already used that for the airport.
Right.
You know, so it's already been in a while, but it's good, so you know, if there's something, you're not going to crash into something that's already in there. But,
So the Google Glass people are saying, look, people, you're fooling yourselves. You've already been filmed all day long from a million different directions. Now it's just obvious, right? So nothing's actually going to change. Well, that's one argument. But what this guy also talks about, and it's really interesting to contemplate that privacy is a fairly recent phenomenon in the history of humans. Until industrialized society, there was no such thing. And if you go off to the developing world and go into an agricultural society, where people still live in villages and life's still fairly simple, there's no privacy. It's a modern privilege of the wealthy and the elite on the planet. It's something that we've become very used to and now expect as a constitutional and human right. But Jeff Jarvis says what we're going to actually do with these technologies is go back to where we were 300 years ago, where there was no privacy. Now, that's a provocative statement, and you might not like the idea of being part of that world, but these are questions that we need to ask, and they're going to be fascinating conversations that we'll have the moment that you're in a supermarket or on a street somewhere and someone's wearing Google Glass. And what are you going to do? Are you going to ask them to turn it off, which I think is a legitimate response? Or are you just going to, I don't know, do that? Wear a bag on your head? Have a wig? But really important questions. There are no answers, but this is where is the internet taking us? This is where it's taking us. Or this is where we're taking ourselves here. The internet isn't doing this to us. We are doing it to ourselves. Another one that is not in the Horizon report, but I think is really important, and it's not as sexy or as controversial as the wearable computing one, but you'll hear a phrase now called big data. And big data refers to those vast amounts of information which sit in databases everywhere around the world, particularly in the science world where there are ongoing computations required, for example, to work out what does a molecule do when it's presented with this substance or in this context. And the amount of data that it takes for a computer to go through that process is just vast. And you can actually sign up to programs where when your computer's asleep, you can actually give permission for your computer to be used by these kind of scientific laboratories elsewhere in the world who use your computing power while you're asleep or not using your computer. That's all. There's no cost to you, there's no harm to you, and you're actually contributing to, in some sense, the scientific good. So that's an example of big data, but big data is also it's these databases of information which were currently, or up till now, have been siloed and separate. The phrase "the new oil" is the new currency, will be the new currency. So oil is the way you got rich in the 80s and 90s, the noughties, particularly the 80s and 90s in this world, but we're now moving to a world where those who are actually controlling and selling the flow of data are the people who are making money, and Facebook, Google, and that's how they become incredibly rich. It's just data. They're selling data, and it is, it's gold. And that's why they want you to talk to each other and link up to her and join her group and acknowledge here, but say, I'll be your friend and join that group, because every time you do that, Facebook's Geiger counter of dollars and cents just goes up every time you click. In an education context, and this is a really, well, it's not that simple really, there's a new thing called learning analytics, and you might remember it was on the chart for the near-term technologies. Learning analytics is that analysis of how people behave when they're in a course. Now, tools like Moodle already do it. You can go into Moodle and ask Moodle to report on, you know, how many students looked at this resource, at what time of day, how long did they spend on this page, how long did they spend on this assignment, which questions did they find difficult. All of this is available in Moodle already. Where it's been taken to another level is that people are actually starting to employ third-party tools to run over Moodle or blogs or wikis or whatever tools you might use and generate a profile for each student. And the purpose is to flag that the student's in trouble. So at week four, for example, there'll be an automatic message to that student. You're clearly having trouble. You need to see your lecturer. The lecturer would get the same message. So rather than wait for you to pick it up, the system is tracking that student's progress and offering suggestions and pathways for that student to kind of address the fact that they're getting behind. So that's the good side of it. But the downside of it is that how are you going to feel? How are students going to feel knowing that the third-party software that's trawling over everything they do and examining things like, it doesn't say there, but these are websites that a student has gone to. They also tone use of grammar, gesture. So all of these kind of things that you wouldn't anticipate that a computer would be good at reading, they're now getting to the point where they are. They can actually check out your language and start to analyse who you are. The good side is it's going to help people do better in courses. Downside, huge privacy issues all over again. But it's called learning analytics. Out there in the wider world, my usual plug about Creative Commons, and people who know me will know I never miss a chance to do it. I hope that I'm not needing to say this to this group of people, that you should be well and truly on the Creative Commons bandwagon. It's a bit weird in TAFE because we always have had this kind of copyrights owned by the minister, but we've got the federal government acknowledging that everything should be produced under a Creative Commons license. The Department of Health in South Australia is doing the same. And why? Because it's breaking down the silos of data. So where once upon a time that only sat in the Department of Health, if that's released under Creative Commons and it's open, then mining can look at that data. You as an individual look at that data. The University of South Australia can look at that data. Everybody can see everybody's data because it's all open and it's all public. And then really interesting things happen. And I was trying to think of examples, and these are particularly earth-shattering. You might be able to think of other ones. But imagine you could sit down to Google and say, how many people arrived in Adelaide by plane on the June the 23rd, 2004? And it would tell you. And where did they come from? And it would tell you. Because Qantas and Virgin's databases will be talking to immigration, which will be talking with tourism, so they'll all be linked and integrated, so this data is no longer locked up, because at the moment it's really time consuming to go through all of that, because you've got to go to all these different places to get the data. Big data has its goal, and Google has at its goal, but that won't be necessary anymore. All of this information would be available. How many students passed third year architecture at UniSA in 1987? How many people had the flu in Adelaide in July 2009? Just whatever you think, anything that can be computed, that information which is currently sitting in databases will be available. Now, the LA Police Department in practice are doing, this is really amazing, and this is truly, I think it's inspiring. The LA Police Department, like any police department, have data about who has committed crimes, when, where, over about 50 years. Down to times of day, neighbourhoods, whether there were black males, white women, young men. And they've actually gone into that data and they've actually now tried to make predictions about what's likely to happen on Wednesday afternoon in that part of LA? And they're often right.
Doesn't a good policeman already know
that? Well, possibly, yes. But it's interesting that, and here's the kind of, so yes, but the more that kind of data becomes obviously accurate, the less the individual, in this case the policeman, was going to rely on their instinct and experience, and the new policeman coming in, I'll just go to the computer, say, where should I go on Wednesday at 3 o'clock? So the downside is that all of these skills that we develop as people who make wise decisions based on information, we might get really lazy and just let the computer or the internet make all these decisions for us, and we'll get intellectually lazy. The counter argument to that is it will free up our brain for stuff that's actually more exciting and more sophisticated, that we don't need to waste our time on this stuff because computers and the internet do this really well.
But won't people not just not put it on a database if it's open? Because, like, if you had no students pass third year architecture at UniSA, UniSA wouldn't want to put it up there, would it?
Well, there's a whole issue, I suppose, but, I mean, generally speaking, these things, and they are recorded, aren't they? This is fairly banal data, really, given on its own. It's only when it's hooked up to all these other different contexts that it becomes really powerful. And again, you can imagine a company that's got access to this stuff, they're going to sell this stuff. So just a few random examples, really. 3D printing is one that I think in TAFE in particular we should be ready for. It's going to explode all over the place in the very short term. These are machines that are connected to a laptop, and you tell it to create, not a phone, but a phone-like object, or a jug like this, or a cup like that, and it will. It just does. So we become makers of stuff. We become creators. We don't rely on external industries and manufacturing. We create things ourselves, at home, or in TAFE classrooms or in labs at the Adelaide Campus of Art. They've got lots of 3D printers in there that people are playing with in design and art, manufacturing, engineering. These are going to be huge in these areas. Anyone who wants to be at the vanguard, the leading edge of technology, needs to get onto 3D printing, because it's going to, I think it's a revolution just waiting to happen. And I think it's interesting that it's happening at the time when manufacturing across the world, particularly in the developed world, is disappearing as we know it or knew it. And in its place steps in 3D printing, which, like so many other things about the internet, the mass approach is gone, the big industrial corporate approach, it's gone, it's individualised, it's personalised, it's customised, and it's what the internet does to everything. It brings things back to the personal, individual, customised level, and the role of the organisation or the corporate identity kind of flounders in the wake of, you know, where did our power and influence go? Well, it went to the person, went to the individual. Badges. New Moodle has badges. A very kind of simple introduction to badges, but these are going to appear like Girl Guide, Boy Scout badges, you know, on your arm. I did this course, and it's going to be like an e-portfolio thing. You're going to have people, rather than produce resumes, they're going to produce a page like this. It will be tagged with all the appropriate metadata, so they won't be Mickey Mouse, they won't be hackable. So an employer will click on that badge to see what it actually means, and it will produce a set of metadata, which is verified by your organisation that they actually did that course. That's badges. Augmented reality. This is really clunky, but what was happening here, I couldn't get a photograph of it, was amazing. So they had a QR code on that pamphlet. They had an iPad here, or a mini iPad, and it was connected to a projector. And what appeared here was a full-scale hologram of the Mars rover. And you could see it right there in the room. And it was just a 3D shape, but you could walk around it. Just a brilliant teaching tool. So that's science fiction coming into the average classroom. So it's clunky at the moment, where you've got to have two people doing stuff, but it's coming. Let's just skip to a couple of last points. This woman's worked over the last 30 years. Sherry Turkle, certainly a preeminent scholar in the field of technology and people and how we interact. And on the question of robots, she said there has been a marked shift. There's no doubt that 30 years ago, if you asked people if you know, could a robot be your friend or your carer, people would dismiss it. That was stupid. Ask the same question to people now, and I said, a percentage of the population will go, yeah, I can see that. Old people who are lonely, people living at home, disabled, lonely people are quite open to the idea of living with a robot or having a carer who is not human. And that's where we've changed. And it's really clear in her data that we have evolved. As this technology comes on board, we do change. And I guess, as a final point, I'm going to make two final points. This guy wrote a book called That. The web, the internet evolved due to an open and transparent philosophy and architecture, which enabled everything that has happened to happen. So it's a very open platform, which basically you can build on and create all the amazing things that the internet has done. And when governments attempt to lock it down, to filter it, to, you know, do all the things they talk about doing to stop all the bad stuff happening on the internet, well, that's the end of innovation. And that's the end of the internet as we know it. So if we want an innovative internet that continues to expand and do all these amazing things, we have to take the good with the bad, according to Jonathan Citrain. And I guess this is the point I wanted to make earlier, that I didn't think this 5 years ago, but I do now. What's the point? Irrelevant. If we can do it, we will. If we can go to the moon, we will. If we can go to Mars, we will. If we can create bionic eyes and create cloned sheep, we will. We won't have the ethical conversation first. It'll be the other way around. We'll create the technology, then we'll have the conversation about what we do with it. So I think everything that's possible, everything that's talked about in this kind of presentation, we'll see it all. So